From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you come to the screening in our film series next week, you'll see Jean-Luc Godard's latest, a perplexing montage of words and images and sounds. It's called Goodbye to Language, and you will find a story in there, but you'll have to spend time with the film to discern it. Godard himself has said the idea and the story is simple. It's about a man and a wife who no longer speak the same language, and the dog they take on walks intervenes and speaks. So there you go. Today in the program, the critic David Sterrett is joining us to offer a primer on the work of Godard. You don't have to be a film buff to come to the screening next week, but it will help if you're game to understand where Godard is coming from. Sterrett says he loves to experiment. Did I mention the film is in 3D? Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are continuing our film series called Through the Lens. And this time, we are trying something different. We're talking today about a 3D feature film created by the renowned French director Jean-Luc Godard. The film is called Goodbye to Language, and it has a story in it. To tie it together, though, Godard surrounds it with a collage of words and images and layers created in 3D. It was a curiosity, if not a sensation, at last year's Cannes Film Festival, where it won the jury prize. It's an experiment for Godard, as a lot of his films are, and we're hoping that you'll make a plan to come see it next Wednesday. We'll give you the details as we go along. Today, the film scholar David Sterrett is joining us to talk about Godard, who in his 80s continues to experiment with film. David Sterrett is a film critic, an author, a scholar. Among his books are The Films of Jean-Luc Godard and a collection of interviews with Godard. He's an adjunct professor at both Columbia University and Maryland Institute College of Art. He also reviews films for NPR member station WHDD's Films in Focus series. And David Sterrett is joining us today from WYPR in Baltimore. David Sterrett, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I should also mention next week the screening of Goodbye to Language. It's a free screening. Our partnership with the Utah Film Center, part of our Through the Lens series. It's going to be next Wednesday night at 7. We'll have more particulars a little bit later on the program. And by the way, you can join the conversation if you like, if you have comments or questions, your own perceptions of Godard's films. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. So, David Sterrett, I wanted to begin by asking, I guess I was interested in what your first experience with a Godard film was. Do you remember when you first saw a Godard film?
I'm not sure I remember the very first time specifically, but it would have been almost certainly Breathless, which was his first feature film, and it was in the great early days of what's called the French New Wave. Mm-hmm. He and François Truffaut and Claude Chabrol and a couple of others, Eric Rohmer, who just died recently, and Jacques Rivette, were kind of turning accepted notions of what movies could be and what movies should be sort of upside down. They had all been film critics, and they had developed certain ideas, particularly, and I would say most importantly, the idea that film can be a personal thing, a personal art, that a film doesn't have to be a big impersonal entertainment machine, that it can be if the director has enough creative strength to channel a particular view of the world, a particular view of the human condition through that army of people that it takes to make a feature film, if a director has a strong enough creative personality to do that, that a film can come out as personal as a painting or a story or, for that matter, a letter to a friend. And Godard was a part of that, and he was one of the people who helped get the ball rolling with that film Breathless way back about 1960.
You've said that he was the most radical of those New Wave filmmakers. What was the new wave was a response to what? What were they seeing that they wanted to respond to or maybe even retaliate against in some way?
Yeah, well, like a lot of film movements that come along of feisty young directors, they were, in fact, rebelling against what they called, kind of sneeringly, the cinema de papa, your father's cinema,
yeah.
Anything that they regarded as old-fashioned, conventional. They were particularly against, for example, literary adaptations because they felt that people always choose these famous, important books to adapt, and then they feel they have to follow the book and they can't put their own creativity into it and so forth. So they were kind of reacting against everything that they saw as old-fashioned and, in great big scare quotes, kind of artistic. At the same time, though, they did understand the importance of pulling in an audience and entertaining people. And Godard, I think, in some ways was, even at the beginning, he was, let's say, one of the most radical in the way that he was willing to kind of let storytelling kind of slip from time to time and get into sort of stylistic adventures. But as time went by, he became more and more and more experimental and radical and strange and idiosyncratic in his filmmaking, even as other people like, say, François Truffaut and Claude Chabrol were kind of becoming more conventional in what they wanted to accomplish.
What was his perspective, and give me a sense of how it evolved over time, to narrative? Generally, as you say, he did begin, it seems, with more, not conventional, probably it would be unfair to say any of his films were ever terribly conventional, but there was more of a narrative in the earlier days, and he tended to depart from that. What was his thinking about how stories should be conveyed, or what was his thinking about story in general?
Yeah, no, it's a really important point. And also, it pertains very much to his very most recent film, Goodbye to Language.
Yeah.
You know, that first feature film of his, Breathless, which made kind of a sensation everywhere where people were seriously interested in film. And this was way back around 1960 when there were a lot of people very interested in film. There still are, but nowadays it's the internet and stuff like that has all gotten in the way and also facilitated certain things. But when he made Breathless, the movie came out longer than it was supposed to be. Not terribly long, but longer. And so when he was under an obligation to cut it down a bit, to make it around an hour and a half or so long, rather than remove this scene or that scene, which certainly could have been done, it's basically a gangster story. A guy is hanging around with his girlfriend in Paris for a few days while he waits for this guy to get back so he can get some money and get out of town. And what Godard did, instead of removing a scene here, a scene there, was he pulled out frames and little bits of shots right from the middle of shots. So there were these kind of unexplained little jumps from one point of view to another. And this revolutionized everything because it had nothing to do with telling the story, this new kind of rhythm. It had everything to do with taking almost a kind of a musical approach to film. You could have these little punctuations like this, like little musical stingers that might come in. It energized the film. And it broke up the old-fashioned flow of the seamless storytelling, and he really liked that. And if you look at the films he made right after that, especially in the early to middle 60s, I don't think this was a conscious plan on his part exactly, but almost every one of them takes a particular genre. The Little Soldier is basically a kind of a spy story. And the Alphaville is a science fiction movie. A Woman is a Woman is a musical. Contempt is a love story about an unhappy couple, and so forth. And in each case, it's as if he took it apart and turned it upside down and knocked all the parts out of a traditional story and then put it back together in his own sort of idiosyncratic way. More than anything else, I think, to see what would happen. These movies were not big hits, but they were tremendously exciting for people who are interested in new approaches to the way the language of film can be used. And he would often talk about his movies as an attempt at a film rather than a film. Because he was the first one to say, hey, you know, yeah, right, it is sort of weird and it doesn't exactly hang together, but I was really trying this and this and I'm glad I didn't. Now next I'm gonna. So it was always this sort of ongoing dialogue with the audience and with the art of film, conducted, I must say, very much on his own terms.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about it is you have a sense of immediacy in all of his films, as if he's almost creating it in front of you. And I think that that's the appeal for a lot of people, is it just seems so spontaneous.
Well, that is a key word. Spontaneity was really important, and or at least the appearance of spontaneity was pretty important to, you know, probably all of those original New Wave filmmakers. But with Godard, it was really a huge thing. And again, the way he did that that jump cutting and so forth in Breathless was done more out of a kind of intuition or even instinct rather than out of some great master plan that he had. In other words, it was spontaneous. Mm-hmm. As time went by, even in his fairly early films, he put less and less importance on having an actual screenplay. He very often would have a screenplay, but or at least an outline of a story, but he would be constantly changing it. And it got to the point where he was slipping new pages of dialogue under his actor's door in the middle of the night, and then eventually handing it to them while they put on their makeup in the morning, constantly changing things. And from a traditional movie making point of view, it was crazy, and it resulted in films which did not tell stories in the usual neat, tidy ways. But what they did have was this sense of extemporaneous creativity and life as it is lived. You know, most of us, even when we go through the most routine kind of a day, it's happening for the first time in front of us. There we are in the middle of it. And that's kind of the way he wanted his films to be. And he kept going farther and farther in that direction.
You know, it occurred to me watching Goodbye to Language that there are elements there that are almost as if created as a documentary. He has his dog in this film, for example. And you see these images of nature, things that may occur, just moments that he can fit into the story, no matter how obscure the story might be. And I'm wondering if you think that describes some of what his work might be, is on some level a documentary that is a response to something he saw the day he was shooting this moment or this thing.
Could well be. What goes on in Godard's... Well, here's a good way of putting it. What goes on in his mind has to always be a matter of speculation. He is famously cryptic, even in his interviews when he's supposedly explaining his work. But it has been said that for him... when you actually go out and shoot a film, or when you have your cinematographers go out and actually shoot a film, he's sending them here and there, and very often he's with them and he's saying, do this and do that. But he is really at that point just gathering material. And again, he has said way back at the beginning of his career, he felt you had to have a screenplay even if you changed it a whole lot. Then he started to think, well, you really don't have to have a screenplay, better just kind of make it up day by day. Then he started saying the screenplay doesn't even come after you've finished shooting the film when you put it together. It comes after you put it together. In other words, you shoot all the material, and that's what basically, and I'm not the first critic to say this, that's basically what filming the film is for Godard. It's just gathering material. And then you edit that material together into a shape, into a form, which is never a straight-ahead conventional storytelling form. And then when the whole thing's done, then you can see what the screenplay was. Then you can see what the idea of the film was. Then he discovers it himself, I think.
It's such a trip to watch him being interviewed. As you said, he can be elusive and he can be cryptic and he can be a little cantankerous from time to time. But I was watching an interview with him, and he said this. He said, the camera is not a certainty. It's a doubt. And I'm wondering if you think that captures something of his perspective, or if it's just him just being, you know, Godard, being cryptic.
Well, I'm sure it's both.
Right.
But no, it's exactly the kind of thing that he likes to say, which is more evocative than explanatory. He loves to say things which sort of convey a certain sort of idea, because if something's right on the nose to him, then it's not so very interesting. So that idea is exactly the kind of way he works. The camera's a doubt, because here you have a camera, and to you and me and almost everybody, it's something that records a visual image or even image and sound of whatever is put in front of it. But for Godard, here's your camera, and then there is the entire world of reality out there. What are you going to film? There's no obvious answer to that, certainly not for him. He doesn't go out with a shot list, and if he gets all these shots right at the end, he'll put it together and he'll have a blockbuster. Rather, it's this tremendous uncertainty, this tremendous doubt, and that is what is thrilling to him. And that is the kind of thrill that he tries to get across to his audience. You said before there are like elements of documentary. Sure, there's actual real life filmed material in Goodbye to Language and in many Godard films, but his movies are really closer to collages than to conventional movies. Collages, you put one thing next to another on a board. In movies, it's one thing after another. And then when he started working extensively with video, it could become one thing after another and one thing on top of another, because you can superimpose. And in Goodbye to Language, it's one thing after another. It's one thing superimposed on top of another some of the time. And it's also with these 3D adventures going on. So it's very much an adventure in seeing and hearing for the audience, rather than just, so that's, I think, what he means when he says it's a doubt, because you got the whole universe there, and what are you going to film? That's all, and then how are you going to put it together? For him, those are always the absolute important questions.
You know, it's important to point out, which you have, that Godard is not for everyone. I mean, his style is seen as provocative, and so the audience is somewhat limited. But I also don't want to sort of make it out as though he's abstruse and inaccessible. Well, can be a little inaccessible, I suppose, but it's not pretentious. Not for everyone, for sure, but certainly worth discovering. Whether you like it or not, at least check it out.
I couldn't agree more, and I would encourage people to do just that. The problem is that we have become so habituated to Hollywood-style storytelling, and, you know, even if we're more adventurous, you know, the sort of European or Asian art film kind of tradition, and, you know, I shouldn't really call it a tradition because there's all different kinds, but what they do is they tell stories. One of Godard's great films, Passion, is about a filmmaker making a film, and the producer keeps telling him, where's the story? And
right.
he doesn't know where the story is. Why do I have to have a story? So that's kind of the way it is with Godard. And so his movies really have to be approached with that in mind. He sees himself, I mean, obviously he's completely a filmmaker, and that's what his whole career has been, and it's what his life has been synonymous with, filmmaking. But he really sees himself in his filmmaking as a painter and a poet. And I think if we look at his films the way we might approach a difficult modern poem, not with the idea of just reading it through and getting it the way, say, you would do with a Stephen King novel, but rather the first time you're just sort of going to collect impressions, but you're going to have to return to it if you really want to get into it, or a complicated, non-figurative or strangely patterned modernist or postmodernist painting or other work of visual art. You don't just figure you're going to look at it and it's going to be a pretty picture like you know, a Caravaggio or a postcard for that matter. It's something, and of course Caravaggio you can turn to a million times and keep seeing new things in it, but with the very dense modernist or postmodernist work, you know you're going to have to return to it a few times before you start to really get it. And that's really the way it is with the Godard film. One of the interviews I did with him years and years ago, he said, I sort of asked him about the difficulty of his films, and he said a couple of things which I just think are useful. One thing is that you don't listen to a great symphony for the first time and then say, okay, got it, you know, the way we almost always do with regular movies. If it's worth remembering, we'll remember it, you know, and that's kind of it, and maybe we'll go see it again with our friends. But with, for example, a great symphony, or for that matter, a great novel, you return to it again and again if you want to start to really fathom it, if you want to start to really kind of understand it. So that was one thing. But he also said, I hope there will be enough for the viewer. Even the first time through, he or she will get something out of it, and there's something there to enjoy, and that will encourage them to want to come back to it again. And I can't think of a better kind of prescription for looking at Goodbye to Language. If you open your eyes and you open your ears, it's just a dazzling explosion of images and sounds. And then if you want to start to get a sense of what's holding it together and what it's trying to say, then you're going to have to return to it maybe a lot of times before you really start to get into it.
I guess that's the trick, right, is to just let it kind of flow over you. Don't try to overthink it, because you can go back if you want, but just experience it on the impulse at first.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that's exactly the way to do it. I sometimes I'm reluctant if I'm showing a Godard film or something else that's pretty dense and complicated to students, to say, now look for this, and this is the other important thing before they've seen a film for the first time, because then everybody's sitting there and sort of solving the puzzle. And believe me, the experts will look at Goodbye to Language for the first time and they will say, what is going on here? Which is very often the response that I have to the first viewing of especially the later Godard films. But if you just kind of watch it as, and by the way, it's only about an hour and 10 minutes long. It's not like you're going to be sitting. So even if you find it completely mystifying, again, try to look at it with fresh eyes, listen to it with fresh ears, and just have that adventure with it as if you were looking at something that really was completely abstract, and just get into the sensuousness of it. And then if that appeals to you and intrigues you, then you can revisit it later on, even in 2D, where, by the way, it still looks pretty sensational.
Yeah, that's how I saw it. I actually can't wait to see it in 3D, and we'll talk about that as we go. We're hoping people will join us next Wednesday. That's April 15th. Boy, something surreal to do on tax day. Come see a Godard film. 7 o'clock, we're presenting a free screening. It's called Goodbye to Language, of course, the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with Utah Film Center. We have details about it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. David Sterrett is with us, a film critic and scholar, the author of The Films of Jean-Luc Godard, joining us today from a studio in Baltimore, and we need to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our Through the Lens film series with a look at the renowned director Jean-Luc Godard. Godard was part of the French New Wave movement of the 60s, but now in his 80s, he's still experimenting with the form. The film scholar David Sterrett is with us talking about Jean-Luc Godard and about the latest film that we're screening next week, next Wednesday. It's called Goodbye to Language. It's a 3D film of Godard, and it's wild. As we'll talk about as we go along. You can join us, by the way, if you do have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Give us a sense, David Sterrett, if you would, about Jean-Luc Godard's, the influences in his life, his personal life. You mentioned that he spent a lot of time in Switzerland as a young man, a young boy, which seemed to have some influence on some of the themes in his work.
Yeah, it's so interesting you ask that, because just the other day I was looking at a video essay written and narrated by an excellent film critic in New York named Kent Jones, who I've known for a lot of years. And Kent is sort of warning against this overuse of the idea of influence. So many movie reviewers are saying, oh, you see the influence of this filmmaker on that filmmaker, and it becomes a sort of a game. And what Kent recalls is Godard once being asked about the influence of, I think it was the French filmmaker Robert Bresson on his work. And Godard paused and he said, I'm not sure whether I've been influenced by Robert Bresson, but I know I was influenced by my father. Now, that's an amazing remark. It really, I mean, we are all influenced by our fathers or whoever is the closest to the traditional father in our own lives. And he didn't get along all that well with his father. Yeah. But that is the kind of a very personal again, very, very eccentric even way of responding to a question like that. And so, I mean, there have been, of course, all kinds of different influences on him over the years, and one of them has been his childhood. His mother particularly came from a wealthy family, and his parents were not living together, and he used to spend a lot of time on his mother's family's country place in Switzerland on a lake, and he remembered this. He still remembers this with great joy as a wonderful time in his life, and he loved the nature of it and all of this. And it's kind of interesting because he later went to Paris and he became a film critic and then he became a big deal filmmaker and, you know, went to film festivals over the world. And in the late 60s and early 70s, he became such a radical left political filmmaker that he was making movies designed not to be showable in any sort of commercial, commercial, you know, to take the capitalism out of the movies by making movies that nobody would ever show. And he was right most of the time. Nobody did want to show them, and they're still hard to see.
Mention what the Jane Fonda, A Letter to Jane, for example, is one of those extremely difficult.
Yeah, it's a good example because, of course, Jane Fonda was a very famous left winger herself, and what Godard and his then partner Jean-Pierre Garin, another very talented filmmaker, they formed a little group, and they were making these completely non-commercial movies. And in Letter to Jane, they go after their fellow lefty Jane Fonda for being as we would say now, and I always use this term with a great deal of sort of skepticism and sardonicism, politically correct. She was not hewing to the line the way she felt they ought to. And they take a photograph that ran in a magazine of Jane Fonda, and I don't remember exactly what's in it, a couple of Vietnamese people, and they just spend about 45 minutes just critiquing this photo. And every once in a while, something else will appear on the screen besides the photo. But it's basically this really long critique of this. So that's an example of the kind of thing that they did. And after that period, you know, in the around the middle 70s, when political agitation all around the world was sort of calming down a little bit after the famous 1960s era, Godard made a sort of a comeback to narrative cinema, but he had been forever changed. And since then, since the mid-60s right up until this exact moment, he has been making movies which, yeah, they're not the political diatribes they once were.
Right.
They're not the politically motivated kind of outcries that they once were. But they are still much more unconventional than they were before that period, you know, up until about the late 1960s. And one of the things that came back into his work pretty soon, around the middle 1970s, was suddenly a whole, and especially in the 80s and after, a whole lot of nature stuff.
Yeah.
Just beautiful, gorgeous, magnificent shots of nature, nature sounds on the soundtrack and so forth, sometimes music intercut with bird cries, things like that. And there's some of this in Goodbye to Language. And people were wondering, why all this nature in Godard? And again, the answer turns out to be that he himself has a tremendous fondness for nature. In fact, he's been living back in Switzerland for decades now, not in the big city, in a little town called Roll. And he still spends time on his mother's family's old property. And the point is that he never, even though he passed through this period of radical rejection of all things capitalistic and all things industrial and all things Western civilization and so forth, he came back not as a conventional filmmaker, because he's still really unconventional in every possible way, but he came back to certain bedrock things in his life. And one of those is his love of music. Another one is his tremendous, profound love of nature, which is just all over almost all of his movies since around the later part of the 1970s.
There's a when he did make that sort of that comeback, and I think it was 1980, sort of marked his reemergence. He did this film in 1985, which was pretty controversial, called Hail Mary. And it's the Madonna story, I suppose you could say. Mary works at her father's gas station in Godard's version, and Joseph is a taxi driver. Talk about that. What that got a lot of people's attention in the 80s as being, you know, obscene and blasphemous and all of those kinds of things. Say something about Hail Mary.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, Hail Mary. I've probably written more on Hail Mary than on any other single Godard film over the years. And I think it's a remarkable piece of work. And yeah, there were people, when it was shown at the New York Film Festival, there were people picketing Lincoln Center and so forth. Then, of course, all they did was to pique extra interest in a film which ordinarily not many people would have been interested in, because it was another movie by that extreme eccentric Jean-Luc Godard. But it is exactly as you said. It is a modern retelling of the story of the Virgin Mary and the birth of Jesus, and she works in her father's gas station and plays basketball, and her boyfriend Joseph drives a taxi, and he can't understand why she is pregnant, and she has a great deal of trouble getting him to understand this, and at the end the little boy is born. So yeah, there were people who saw this as outrageous and blasphemous and so forth, and you know, what Godard, some of the things he said, I think, were right on point. You know, there was a certain time, you know, think back to the Middle Ages, when there were only certain ways in which you were allowed to depict the Virgin Mary. And one of the results of that was that people lost all sense of her as having been a real person who actually lived and walked and gave birth on the same planet Earth that we all inhabit. And so you started to get, in the Renaissance and after, all kinds of different ways. There was a time when it was considered scandalous and blasphemous to depict the Virgin Mary with bare feet, for example. So Godard goes farther than that. He has this young character who represents the Virgin Mary playing basketball and so forth. And there are times when we see her nude in the film. They're not particularly erotic scenes, but there is some nudity. And, you know, I did some research a number of years ago. I found out there's a whole tradition of art going back for centuries of painting that shows Mary particularly with bared breasts, because these are symbolic of her nourishing the world, of her feeding all of us infants with the power and presence of Christ. So Godard was not making, I think, a traditionally pious film, but he was doing something which in his mind was not in any way blasphemous or disrespectful. And in fact, one of the sources that he drew on when he was making that movie was the work of a French psychoanalyst named Françoise Dolto. And she's also quoted, along with about 10,000 other people, in Goodbye to Language.
Yeah.
And Dolto, psychoanalyst that she was, was profoundly religious, profoundly Roman Catholic in her sensibility. And Godard was drawing very much on her work. So no, it's a misunderstood film. It is not a sacrilegious film.
Yeah. What was he, to talk to him, what was he like to speak with? I mean, you hear stories of him being combative. I mean, there's the famous story where he got in a fight with Norman Mailer making the film King Lear, and Mailer storms out, and Gerard Depardieu storms out in a film that they were working on together. What was he like? Can you describe? Mercurial is the way I imagine him, but I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, I've talked with him a couple of times, but it was many years ago, and I really only remember the second time. And he, you know, the first time was fine, mm-hmm. and the second time he was very forthcoming. He did speak some English, and he did understand some English, but he always wanted to have a translator there in case it was needed, and occasionally it was. Right. And, you know, I think that if he sensed that you had a serious interest in his work and really were sympathetic toward it and wanted to understand it better and to hear what his, then he was just going to deal with you just fine. And I'm sure there are exceptions to that because he always has been, sure, a cantankerous person, I think, in a lot of ways, starting with his whole approach to making movies. And yeah, there were times when he drove people clear out of the project. Norman Mailer objected because Godard handed him a whole bunch of new dialogue, and Norman Mailer said, I am perfectly happy to say this stuff, except you've named my character Norman Mailer. And I'm not going to say these stuff under my own name. I'm going to play it as a fictional character only. Yeah. And when Godard wouldn't compromise, then Mailer walked out. And you're right, the huge French superstar Gérard Depardieu walked out of a film perhaps appropriately called Hélas pour moi, which basically means woe is me. And you know, that movie, even Godard admitted that it was all sort of cockamamie. And he's made other movies that are even more sort of crazy than that. But I found him perfectly forthcoming when I spoke with him, and I do think that if he has, you know, if he feels that you're speaking to him with goodwill, he will return that. I remember seeing more than once, actually, a segment of the Dick Cavett show back when Dick was on the air, where Godard came on, and Godard is answering the questions in his sort of semi-humorous, semi-cryptic way. And at one point, Dick Cavett says, and this was a question that used to be on the minds of movie lovers, how come your French are so crazy about Jerry Lewis? Because Godard was one of those French critics. Jerry Lewis is a great artist of the screen. And I myself find Jerry Lewis a very interesting filmmaker. But Godard all of a sudden gets really down to earth. And you can see that he's really earnest about this. He wants to explain why he feels Jerry Lewis was a great painter on the screen and his use of color and shape and form. And you know, it's only a minute or two, I suppose, that little bit of it. But, you know, again, if he felt that you were willing to do your darndest to get on his wavelength, he was going to be on that wavelength too. And he would talk to you, even though a lot of the things he said might be a bit puzzling. You know, a key word with him, his approach to filmmaking, his approach to everything is intuitive. You used the word spontaneity before. Spontaneous, intuitive. Intuitive, working out of what feels right at this moment. And he regarded the interview as a kind of a minor art form to be treated in the same way. And again, just like he doesn't like his filmmaking to be on the nose, telling you a story that you can watch and get, he wants it to be much more, some of us would say, complex or even opaque than that. He would probably say more interesting than that. But in the same way, he wants his interviews to be interesting. He wants you to have to puzzle out what he means and come to your own intuitive understandings of what he's saying, just as he hopes you'll come to your own intuitive understanding of what he's after in a particular movie.
Well, Dick Cavett was great, and that's a great question about Jerry Lewis. Who would have thought to ask Jean-Luc Godard? That's terrific. We'll put a link, by the way, to the Dick Cavett interview with Godard, because it is actually kind of fun to watch. David Sterrett is with us, film critic, scholar. He's the author of The Films of Jean-Luc Godard. Next week on Wednesday, that's April 15th at 7 o'clock, we're presenting a free screening of Goodbye to Language at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with Utah Film Center. We have details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We're presenting it in 3D, just so you know, which is really fun. When we get back from a break, we'll talk a little bit more about Goodbye to Language. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the scholar and critic David Sterrett. He is the author of the book, The Films of Jean-Luc Godard. We're screening next Wednesday Jean-Luc Godard's Goodbye to Language, and we've asked David Sterrett to help put his work and this particular film in perspective for us. David Sterrett, I wanted to ask you, do we know where this idea came from for Godard for this film?
Well, I think it came, first of all, from his curiosity about 3D, his wanting to experiment with that and see what could be accomplished with that. So I think that was maybe the first, one of the motivations for this. I don't think that was out of the picture, that he had this project and he said, this must be in 3D. You know, I think it was partly because he wanted to work with 3D.
Yeah.
But also, according to him, there really is a kind of a story, and it's really simple. And it's the kind of story that he will always sort of want to put together, I think. He says it's about a couple, mm-hmm. and they have a dog. And the couple isn't getting along all that well, but they have a dog, and the dog sort of brings them together. And then he says, actually, in an interview that's being circulated on the DVD edition of Goodbye to Language, he says, Alfred Hitchcock once said, Hitchcock, by the way, being a total hero of Godard's and also of mine, Alfred Hitchcock once said, if you want the audience to understand something, say it twice. So, Godard says, I made a second couple, except they don't have a dog. And there's the story such as it is, but there is so much stuff all jam-packed around that I really think that the basic idea of it was to take what is... He has always liked the idea of sound and image, the two main elements, of course, of any movie in our time, sound plus image, as being not imitations of each other, where you see somebody talking and you hear what they're saying and that's it. Rather, that they sort of operate separately and independently of each other, and that it's the connections between them are indirect, and that we can sort of put things together in different ways in our own minds as we look and listen to the film. And so I think that he felt that using 3D would allow him to carry that to yet another phase by now having the sound of this film, by the way, is extremely layered. It's always coming at you from different directions and in different combinations of sound effect and or natural sounds, more likely, and voices and music and whatnot. So that's always happening. But also now we could have not only the layering of images one after another and one on top of another, but this whole extra dimension now of the different planes of the image, what's near you, what's coming out at you, what's receding into the distance from you. And I think that that was really what he wanted to accomplish. At the same time, as a person who is really in love with language, and just about every single Godard film, is jam-packed with words.
Yeah.
Sometimes printed on the screen, people talking all the time. I think that he's very interested with the idea that the more advanced our visual media become, the more advanced, for example, cinema becomes in its ability to present us with astonishing sights and sounds, the farther removed it gets from just the language that actually holds our lives together and binds us to one another in the actual lives that we actually live. And so I think that one of the meanings of the title, Goodbye to Language, is he's saying in one way, I think as a kind of a joke, goodbye to the old cinema language before 3D.
Yeah.
But he's also saying, I think, are we in danger of saying goodbye to language in forgetting just the meaning of simple communication, the kind of thing that we do with words in our own actual everyday lives? He has also pointed out, as one final thing on that topic, that in a part of Switzerland where he is very familiar, there's a word the word for farewell means both goodbye and hello, right, depending on the time of day, on the tone of voice you use, and so forth. So he is also, at the same time as says goodbye to language, which is maybe one way of speaking that maybe is no longer with us or will not always be with us. He's saying hello to another kind of language that is probably being born right now with the internet, with telephone technology, and all that sort of thing. So, you know, the title has many meanings, and I think that they were all in his mind, maybe not when he started to make the film, but by the time he had gotten done editing the film.
And it's so interesting that in the credits, in a fairly prominent place, he mentions all of the cameras that he's used to make this film. And among them, I wrote, like, a GoPro, a mini Sony, a flip-flop camera, you know, along with others. And it's interesting. I guess this is really sort of what he loves to do, is experiment. I mean, I know I'd read the story that he had his own sort of small version of a 35-millimeter film, camera, created because he wanted it to be unwieldy, wanted it to be I think he put it in his glove box in his car or something like that. So he's always experimenting with the technology, I suppose.
Yeah, always doing that. And yet at the same time, he says to this day that he loved the huge, gigantic old Mitchell cameras that they used in Hollywood, which he used a lot too, especially in the earlier parts of his career. But, you know, on one important level, Jean-Luc Godard comes from the mad scientist school of cinema. He is always experimenting and always trying things that perhaps man was not meant to tamper with equipment and technology and stuff. And I think that's one of the things that made him want to make Goodbye to Language in 3D. And he has, in fact, used technology in really innovative ways. And, you know, I've been a lot of the sort of great world auteurs have been using 3D in the past few years. Martin Scorsese made Hugo, and Werner Herzog made Cave of Forgotten Dreams, and Ang Lee made Life of Pi. And there have been others. And so, you know, Godard is yet another one of these great filmmakers who wants to sort of give this a shot. But when I saw Goodbye to Language for the first time in 3D, it was just so far beyond, just as a visual phenomenon, beyond any 3D I had seen before. So you look into this a little bit, and it turns out that he was using little cameras, which sometimes were not particularly sophisticated on their own, and he was putting one next to the other the way that you customarily do that's basically what a 3D camera is doing. It's taking two images that approximate what you see out of your two eyes, which gives you the perception of depth. But he wasn't wasn't pointing the two cameras in the same way that the customary 3D camera does, which again is to sort of mimic the way our eyes point in somewhat different directions, but they converge on whatever it is we're looking at. He had these two cameras looking a little bit sort of straight ahead, which our eyes don't do. And then he used software to manipulate this in video form or digital form on the computer. And that is how he created these effects, which are in some cases just astoundingly great 3D. And in other cases, just departures from anything you've ever seen before, as when a couple of times during the film, the two cameras go off in really different directions. And it's as if suddenly, when you were just minding your own business, your two eyes went off in completely different directions at the same time and somehow produced not a mass of confusion, but this astonishing, disorienting visual experience that you'd never had before. And it doesn't last very long, and then we come back to, quote, normal, unquote. But he did this sort of thing, again, not with a conventional 3D camera, and he did it with computer manipulation, and the effects are amazing. You know, one of the characters, as we've mentioned, is a dog, and he's a lovely dog, and yeah, his name is Roxy Mieville, and he belongs to Godard and his longtime companion, Anne-Marie Mieville. And there are some shots, these were my girlfriend's favorite shots in the movie, there are some shots in the film where the dog is in close-up, and his snout seems to be nuzzling your neck. I have never seen 3D that came out at me as effectively as that dog snout does. It's not the only thing in the film that does that, but it's absolutely charming.
You know, it's so interesting. It's hard to tease out any one theme from a film like this. I mean, there's so much there. There's a woman who says to me what seemed terribly profound, this idea that I am here to tell you no. I mean, there are all these really big existential themes in here. And I'm wondering, is this, for Godard, do you know, self-referential, autobiographical, personal in some way, this particular story?
All of his filmmaking is profoundly personal, yeah. And I'm sure that there are real autobiographical elements in the film, such as all of the footage of nature, much of which I'm sure was taken in the parts of Switzerland where he has spent a good deal of his life, both as a child and as an adult. So there is that literal kind of autobiographical element. But there is more. It is the, as direct as he can make it, an expression of his interests, his concerns, his worldview, his hopes, his fears, all the kinds of things that you can't say directly through straight-ahead sentences, and that you can't say directly through straight-ahead shots edited in a nice linear form. It's more like following the process of thinking of a person who thinks really fast and really actively and really spontaneously and instinctively. And I think that's maybe what it all is going to come down to. I don't think he wants there to be any single meaning in the film. Yeah. I think he wants there to be a vast multiplicity, a huge explosion of meanings that he himself may be making sense out of in years to come when he revisits the film. And he invites us, I think, to revisit the film and try to get deeper into it and take from it what we see in it. The important thing, I'm going to repeat something I said a little bit earlier, is to, you know, look at this more like you'd look at some very innovative painting. You've never seen anything like it before that you run across in a museum. And in a museum setting, you don't kind of laugh and say, well, that's just silly. Mm-hmm. Ideally, if you've gone to the museum in the first place, you think, well, now that's interesting. I can't really make sense out of it. Let me just stop here a minute and think and just feel for a little bit. And I really think that's the way to go about good body language. Just take it in. Pause, think about it while it's on the screen, but more just experience its sensory qualities, its sights and its sound, and you'll have the rest of your life to think about it later, and you can get the DVD if you're interested in this sort of thing and study it more, even if it's just in 2D. And if this isn't for you, it's going to be over in about an hour and 10 minutes, and then you can go to the multiplex.
David Starrett, he's the author of The Films of Jean-Luc Godard, reviewer for Films in Focus on NPR member station WHDD. He joined us today from WYPR in Baltimore. David Starrett, that was a lot of fun. Thank you very much for being with us.
I enjoyed it so much. Thank you.
Remember, next Wednesday, that's April 15th, we're presenting a free screening of Goodbye to Language at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. The screening is at 7 o'clock. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction for the program from Tim Slover. Produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.